Yes, Honest Actors is back with brand new episodes every Friday. To help me continue releasing new episodes without a sponsor, or to say thanks for your favourite old ones, click the support link in the episode description. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. It's a one-off, feeling generous, good deed for the day sort of thing. Think of it as bumping into me and buying me a drink. To find out more, click the support link. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
Yeah, mine's a large red.
I hate those guys.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
My name is Brona Wall, and you are listening to the Honest Actors Podcast.
Hi, my name is Jonathan Harden, and you're listening to the Honest Actors Podcast. I'm back after a short break, so thank you for bearing with me during that. And over that break, I have made the decision to stop doing the lockdown-themed chats. I think they've served their purpose, and for most people now, lockdown is, to all intents and purposes, over. Or if it's not and people are still shielding, they're at least looking forward with some optimism towards a time whenever they can go back into the world at large. So rather than keep emphasizing the negative of that experience, I thought the time had come to just ignore it and hope that it goes away. So thanks to everybody who did those lockdown chats, and thanks for listening to them. They're still available. I'll leave them up forevermore. I had a few more lined up, but I just think, like I say, we're in danger of perpetuating this thing whenever I really just want to be more hopeful than that. So back to normal. I'm going to go to 2 weeks between episodes, which is really, I suppose, my release rate of the previous three series. One a week at the start of lockdown seemed totally doable, and then through a number of things, I hurt my back, and with having a baby in the house and all that that entails, and not having the availability of any kind of childcare support, and both Bruno and I trying to work in some way, it really just was becoming too much. So while this podcast has never paid the bills, it certainly seems now that while my focus is on paying the bills like everybody else and finding new ways to pay those bills, that the podcast, not for the first time, has to take a back seat a bit. So one episode a fortnight, I think, is realistic. And if you've been one of the people who supported Honest Actors via the Acast support scheme, which you can find at supporter.acast.com/honestactors, thank you to all those people. You can continue to support one-off. It's a one-off kind of thing, as I say at the top of the podcast. And it really is appreciated. Like I say, it makes me more likely to give up the time to give over to the podcast if I know that at least the costs are being covered. So thank you to those small number of people who have supported it that way. If you're not supporting it that way, I understand. Like I say, we're all in the same boat in some ways. So please do share it on social media. I haven't said that since the start of this series, but it would be really helpful if you just kind of share your favorite bits or let people know that it's back, because again, one of the things that keeps me coming back to this microphone to have these chats is knowing that people out there are listening and getting something from it. And I guess because I haven't been pushing that and haven't been asking people so much to do that, it feels a little bit like radio silence. I know people are listening because I can see the figures, but equally, it's just nice when people, you know, I see tweets, people appreciating interviews or some of the guests and, you know, enjoying particular moments or particular discussions that we have around certain things. So please do tweet, Instagram, whatever else, TikTok a thing. I'm old now, I don't know. Anyway, today's episode is with Brona Waugh. I've wanted to get Brona on the show for a long time, not least because there aren't many podcasts out there that can say they've had two Bronas on. I guess Irishman Abroad, which Brona Waugh did, would be one. I guess they've probably had several Bronas. But yeah, it's just nice to have another Northern Irish guest and to have chats with a friend or at least an acquaintance that I've never had before, which seems to be a recurring theme of this series. I'm going to the people that I know or feel I know and finding out that I didn't know much about them at all. So I'm enjoying that. I hope you are too. Anyway, here it is. Episode, who knows, with Brona Waugh. Enjoy. Beautiful. Very clear there. I like how you slowed it down towards the end there. Very clear. A seasoned professional. It's interesting to see how people do that. You know, how do you bring something fresh to something that's been so often done? And the answer is just with a bit of shift of pace. Okay. So thanks very much, first of all, for doing this.
Thank you for asking.
I really appreciate you agreeing. I've been wanting to have you for a long time, but it was like, I can't ask you straight after Irishman Abroad because it looks like I want some of that on my show. She's brilliant. So thanks very much anyway. I'm glad I'm doing another series to get kind of people that have been meaning the interview for ages off of this.
And it's needed.
Well, let's talk about this
now. Like, your podcast is needed now more than ever.
Do you know what? It's one of the reasons why I started doing it again was because I felt like I needed to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And Brona's always my kind of like barometer of everything because she'll be really honest and say to me like, babes, that's fucking terrible, or I think you can do better, or nah, don't do any more of that. And I said I was doing it again and she was like, oh yes, I can't wait to listen to it. And I was like, okay. Now in fairness, neither of us have had a chance to listen to anything because when we walk in, we're very conscious of not sticking headphones in and all that kind of carry on. So I don't know when I'm going to get a chance to listen to podcast. Normally it's on holiday, but I'm not getting one of those anytime soon. But sure. Right. Listen, tell me this, Brona Waugh. How did you get into acting, Brona Waugh?
How I got into acting was with a lot of persistence because nobody in my family does it. My mother was a businesswoman, like she worked in IT and she was a single mother. And I didn't have anybody who was in the arts. My granny, who I lived with for some time growing up, was an English literature lecturer at the University of Ulster in McGee in Derry. And so she had a lot of friends that were writers and playwrights, like people like Frank McGuinness and stuff. So I guess I grew up with her having these very kind of bougie dinner parties. Like, we had no money, but my granny always used to say she would spend her last tenner on a really good bottle of red wine. So we never really had that much money, but we always would have like these people around and people with guitars and singing and kind of, I don't know, I just loved the crack and kind of loved the storytelling aspect of it. And I was an only child because I was as my mum says, a happy accident. I don't know if it was happy, but it was an accident. So it was just me and her. And I think acting came about because you kind of want to make stories for yourself and you kind of want to entertain other people and the other adults in the group. And so it was just something, I mean, as long as I can remember, like since I was about five, it's as long as I can remember, that's what I wanted to do. And my granny was very good about taking me to the theatre when I was wee. Like, she would take me to the Riverside. I was born in Coleraine and there was a regional theatre there called the Riverside, and she would take me to go and see plays there, and that kind of really sparked an interest. And then I started going to youth theatre there as well, and that was such a seminal moment of doing that when I was like sort of 12, of going, wow, like these are my tribe, these are our people, you know. I went to a school in Coleraine where I didn't really fit in very much, I didn't fit in very well to the community that we lived in. So being in part of that youth theatre really brought me a sense of belonging and a sense of escapism, which I felt like I really needed. And so that was kind of the beginning of it all, really, was that. And it's why I'm very passionate about teaching younger people now and trying to open up youth theatre and classes and things to people that are in other ways other than just drama school, because I have massive issues about that.
So those dinner parties are interesting, right? Because, I mean, that's not something I would have been, I mean, something I aspire to do myself when I'm growing up. But that's fascinating to me that there's a child at the centre of this world, the only child in the house, right? That's being exposed to these kind of conversations which are creative or interesting or perhaps at times political and politicised, particularly in the north of Ireland and, you know, whenever you were growing up. But were any of those people involved in, were they performers?
My mum's best friend was a woman called, she is a woman called Imelda Foley, who was a producer, theatre producer. And her daughter, Anna, was my best friend. We were born 3 months apart, and Imelda was a single mum too. And our house in Corrine was this big old dilapidated kind of townhouse. And my granny spent over the years doing it up and getting it all sorted and stuff. But it kind of was a meeting point where everybody would stay. It ended up becoming a B&B because it was such a big old house. And Imelda would stay there a lot of the time, and so would Anna. And so Imelda was a producer and also worked for the Arts Council. So I met a lot of people sort of through her at dinner parties. And my granny got into being a B&B because she would let theatre companies that were visiting the Riverside come and stay at the house. And then that's how it kind of turned into a B&B.
Right.
The business. And I remember being so excited meeting these actors and these people that were, you know, storytellers. And I think what I loved about acting and from those very early memories of those kind of dinner parties and stuff was making people laugh and making up stories or telling stories to make people laugh, and that kind of form of escapism. I just really liked it because, you know yourself, being from where we're from, Corrine's not the most exciting town. There's not a lot going on apart from the theatre. So it's not a place I felt I ever fitted into, and I never really felt our family fit. You know, it was just, we were kind of black sheep of the town, apart from the other people at the uni and stuff. So
it's really a town, to put it in context for people who don't know. It's a town that shouldn't have a university for loads of reasons.
It's been
totally incongruous that you should put a theatre of that size and a building with those people in it.
It was almost like totally alien for that to be
very conservative,
in
Corrine, very conservative,
which is very Bible Belt. Yep. It's a Bible Belt town. Like I went to a very, a Protestant primary school, and I didn't fit in there. I was a real black sheep there. Everybody went to very religious Bible Belt type churches, Baptist, Methodist, Free Presbyterian. You know, for anybody who's not from the North of Ireland, it's a very, think of America and the Deep South, it's a real Bible Belt kind of.
They would pick at the theatre and stuff
camp
as well.
Yeah. My granny's Canadian, and she was an outsider herself. And I think she just attracted outsiders and attracted, she opened her doors to people that didn't, just everybody knew her in the town. And then she set up this B&B and this wee shop, and it really opened doors to me to go and I can do whatever I want to do. Cause you know, my mom's a businesswoman.
They were totally supportive, were they? They were like, that was always.
No, well, my mother had dropped out of university and came to business very late in life. Basically when she got pregnant, she was like, right, I've got to provide for my child. So she went to the University of Ulster in Corrine and did IT because everybody was saying, oh, computers are the things to do in the 80s to earn money. So that's what she did. But mum had always been like, she just was like, as long as you get an education, you can do whatever you want to do if you're passionate. But whatever you do, you have to do it with passion or don't do it at all. But you must have the education to back that up. And that's why she was very strict about me getting a degree. She wanted me to have a degree because she felt like it was very probable that I wouldn't make it as an actor or I wouldn't make a living. And so she wanted me to get a degree so that I would be able to teach or fall back on something, which thank God she did, because that's what I've had to do.
What was your first paid job then? So jumping from you know, the position of your mum encouraging you to get an education, obviously she's a bias in that regard anyway. What do you do when you come out of that education, and what's the first time you get paid to act? Do you remember?
So we actually sort of missed a tiny wee bit to fill in the gaps, which was my mum got a job in IBM, which was a computer company in Thailand in Bangkok. And so
this story gets
me
better.
And her just up so we just up sticks and moved to Bangkok. I was at Dominican Convent School in Port Stewart and literally about to start my first year of secondary school. And then she got this job in Bangkok, and she had to move and make the decision in 3 months. And I guess because she was a single mom, it was just like, yeah, I can do it. She was dating a guy who worked at the same company as her. But yeah, we just decided to up sticks and move. I mean, I didn't even know where Bangkok was. I was so ignorant to the geography of the world. I thought it was,
wow.
You know, I knew it was somewhere
else.
So
hold on, this is a really good film. So cultural, absolute cultural, like night and day, really.
Like
right?
Ignorant. Yeah, and total ignorance. I mean, having grown up, like my only knowledge of kind of culture and identity was to do with the tribal, you know, politics and cultural identity of being from the north of Ireland. And that felt like this big, you know, huge. And then suddenly you get thrown into this school in Bangkok. And I was the only white girl in my class, which was really
great
for me.
This is a great story.
But it was
can I play you in the film of your life, please?
It was so good for me. It was so good, like, for me to experience being taken out of something that seemed so massive.
But listen,
like,
then
you know,
what happens with acting? Like, I know nothing culturally. So
in that school, it was a new international school of Thailand, and a casting director for the film Good Morning Vietnam came to our school. They were looking for sick formers, lads, to be extras in the film to be the soldiers, because Vietnam was still closed at the time they made the film. So they were shooting the film in Thailand. And the idiot that I am, I went in for the audition. So they
Amazing.
Were looking for lads that were like 16 to 18 that could be army like soldiers. So I strapped.
This is like Shakespeare in Love.
I strapped my boobs down.
And, this is Shakespeare in Love.
I think I was 12 and I was quite developed. And I strapped my boobs down and put this t-shirt on and these camo trousers and a baseball cap on, and I went in and I had an American accent because everybody in our school did. It's kind of like an international So I went into the audition and the casting director just laughed, I think, at my brass balls of just walking in and pretending to be a boy.
Or not. Your lack of brass balls was the problem.
So she just said, no, you're not right for this. But they kind of laughed and they interviewed me and talked to me, and then I walked away. And then a couple of weeks later, they came back to the school because they were casting a soap in Thailand and they were looking for an American family.
This story is great.
So I played the daughter in this. It was like a let's learn English kind of, it was like a really awful language show that basically they filmed every episode in Thai.
And where can we Google that?
Every episode in English. Oh, Ma's got them all on VHS. Like, mommy's got them.
I'm Googling.
Mum's got them all on videotape. And it's so funny because the makeup artist didn't know how to deal with curly hair. I've got really curly hair. So they would iron my hair on an ironing board and then they would plait it like Pippi Longstockings. But it was me and my best mate, Pai Lin, in school, and we and another guy called Mong Sai, and we, the three of us, did it. And it was my first experience of being on a set. And from that, a lot of small opportunities arose from that because I spoke Thai, and I think it was a bit of a novelty being white and this kid with frizzy curly hair who spoke Thai. And so
amazing.
I did
and commercials followed.
Yeah, commercials,
of course,
and just
of course.
Like sort of MTV like VJ spots and things like that. So I earned a bit of money, and my mum wouldn't let me spend any of the money because we'd grown up very poor, and she had always believed like save, and she knew how precarious it was doing acting. And so everything got put away in the bank account, apart from I was allowed to go to the department store and I bought a dress, which was, I think it was 480 baht, which was about 12 quid at the time. But that was quite expensive then. I saved all the rest. And yeah, she just had really instilled that idea in me of like, nothing certain, and this is a very precarious thing, and it will probably end. And of course it does. Right. Because then,
how right she was to have her.
Yeah.
So that's kind of amazing. I never knew that about you. Yeah. Like, I've never.
Well, I never told people in Belfast. It's funny because a lot of my Belfast mates say, "Why did you never tell that to me?" But it's because when I used to go home back to Coleraine in the summer, my friends and my friends in Belfast didn't it was not okay to talk about it, and it seemed like you were showing off, like going, "Oh, you're talking about living in Bangkok and all this," and just everybody.
Yeah, you've got it. You're going to a place where literally nobody has lived anywhere but.
Yeah, exactly. So I learned very quickly to never speak about it, and I never spoke about it. And on my first week of drama school, I went to GSA, and on my first week of drama school, we were at the Students' Union, and these five Thai students came running up and started chattering to me in Thai and like recognized me and asked for pictures. And the other guys in my class were like, "What the hell is going on? Like, who is this kid?"
So post Bangkok.
Then I went to drama school.
That's not something I was thinking about tonight. I was like, Bangkok was not going to get mentioned. That's totally... that's amazing. So what's your first job coming out of GSA?
It took forever. I couldn't get an agent. I couldn't get a job. It was just, it was really hard, as it is for loads of graduates. I think my first job was a thing about the Manhattan A-bomb. It was like a real, a documentary,
docudrama.
Yes. I mean, and that's in the loosest possible terms. I was in like smoked out, faded out, kind of blurry backshot. But I took it so seriously. I went to charity shops and bought books on physics. I thought I was going to need to know all of this. And of course, I had no lines and didn't have to do anything. And so I think I was paid about £80 for it.
So it was hard coming out of GSA, right? And like you say, that's the experience of a lot of people. But I guess you must, and this is kind of jumping forward to a certain degree in terms of where I normally go with this, but that must teach you something coming out. Like made you a different kind of actor. Because I imagine if you get a job straight out.
The people that did very well in drama school, who were the favourites in drama school, interestingly, were not the ones that ended up working solidly as actors. And some of the people that struggled more are the people who kind of have sustained that. So I think it taught me very early on about rejection and the being realistic about the way the industry was. So I think...
Did it change how you approached getting work?
Because I can't remember who said it to me. It might have been my mummy. I can't remember. Someone said to me, "If something's not working for you, change it." And I was working in a car dealership in Guildford after graduation to pay off my fees. And I was selling cars. And I was doing really well at the car sales because you get commission. But I thought, God, this will be very easy to slip into this job and kind of forget, the career stuff. But I wasn't getting any auditions. And there was an audition that came up in Murphy's Law to play Jimmy Nesbitt's niece. Now, Jimmy is from Coleraine, and I couldn't get on Spotlight. I couldn't get an audition at all. And I thought, I couldn't get an audition to play this man's niece. And there was about four of us from Coleraine, and you think, this is mad if you can't even get seen for that. So my mum said to me, if something's not working, change it. And I thought, I need to leave London. And it was somebody from a theatre company. I think it might have been Nick Philippou, this director, that had said, start small and work big. Like, go back to your roots and hone everything and then expand. Because you're a tiny fish in this giant sea in London, and you don't have an agent and you don't have any prospects or opportunities at all. but what is your one USP? And I say this to the students I teach all the time. What is your one unique selling point that is different about you than anybody else? And for me, in my year, it was, I'm from Belfast. So Northern Ireland, you know, my accent's always been Belfast. But so I decided to move back home. And I thought, if I can move back home and start there and start building some connections and getting some work there, then eventually I can move back to London. But I think I've started too big and I need to start where I'm from.
I think that's great advice. I really do.
And I teach now screen acting at a drama school, and I say this to my students in their second year to give them time to start planning. And it's why I'm very passionate about teaching at drama schools now, is that one of the first things I tell them on their first day of term is forget everything you're being told at this institution, because it's all bollocks. Like, I have a massive issue about what is taught at drama schools, how it's taught and who it's taught by. And I'm not frightened or afraid to be quite vocal about that, because I think there's huge, huge issues about our institutions and how they're run. So part of what I felt passionate about having the opportunity to go and speak with these young actors is to go down the first lesson of every, you know, class I do with them, and they'll attest to this, is I go, whatever the rest of everybody else told you here is bollocks. I love how you sound. I love where you're from. I don't want you to change anything about your voice.
You're 100% right.
Because when I was at drama school, all I got was, you have to change your voice. You have to change your accent. You'll never work with that voice. So I try really hard to encourage every young actor I work with to embrace who they are, but to embrace their uniqueness, because it's our uniqueness that is what makes us different to every other actor. And some drama schools seem to want to churn you out into some package that is, you know, representative maybe of the industry in 1983, but not now, you know?
No, totally.
I went back home and kind of started from the ground up, and I couldn't get an agent for ages. And then I managed to get the lovely PD, who we know well. P. Diddy.
Yep.
P. Diddy. And he repped myself and the other lovely Brona, who was wildly more successful than me, because, and I actually,
I remember you popping up in Belfast. I don't know what it was in, but it was like,
was it One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
No, it was just, but it was before that.
I remember
having a sense of you, and that's why I asked the question about, did it change how you approach getting work, of being, and I say this in a positive sense, a hustler.
Oh yeah.
Of somebody who was 100%. Like on it and wasn't going to, you know, to quote Hamilton, was not going to give away her shot.
100%. And I think it's because my mum is a businesswoman and a single mother. She always taught me to fight for everything and to hustle. Like, that's something she really instilled in me, was it's not going to come to you on a plate. You've got to create an opportunity and you've got to go out there and get it. And I definitely think when I was younger and bullshitter that it probably rubbed people up the wrong way, or it could have, you know, potentially come across as like, oh fuck, right, she's coming in.
I think that's great.
Get what she wants.
I've always thought that's great.
I knew what I wanted and I wanted to get it. And I'm a passionate people person and wanting to make connections. And I've always been really aware of collaborating with people, and collaboration is such a key thing. And I say this to all my young actors as well, is, you know, create your own work, write, get together with other actors and like-minded people so that you can exercise your voice.
Oh, don't get together with other actors. It's the worst thing you could do.
They're getting drunk and just moaning.
It's the worst thing. No, don't get... It's just like, everybody pours their fucking anxiety into the central pot. I used to have a couple of friends that I'd meet for coffee, and I'd be like, Bruno, I've got to go and meet whatever. And I'd be getting into it knowing that I was going to have to listen.
Yeah, to them moaning.
To them moan for an
but
hour.
Do you not think that's a wee bit potentially something about, like, I think that's about coming from smaller acting communities, because there's something about being more anonymous when you're here. Like, I know some acting graduates from our drama school that said as soon as they left drama school and were able to meet actors anonymously out of the community of that drama school, things just, they didn't feel as confined. And I think sometimes when you're from a small city or a small town, it can be a bit like that.
Maybe.
Like, it can be quite insular and quite, and I must say, like, I find it very intimidating when I moved back to Belfast. Because, like, you and Bruno went to Queen's University,
we designed it that way.
And Queen's was a very tight, you know, they were tight.
To intimidate.
And like, it was very hard to kind of break into that and break into the local theater groups, and everybody knew everybody. Yeah, and it was mental. Very, very hard to get seen or get taken seriously. And, but I couldn't get a break. So I decided in the pub one night, chatting to another actor, Jer McCabe. Jared and I were chatting, and he's another actor from home, and he...
Another hustler,
exactly. Yep. And he couldn't get work out of Panto. He always played the Panto Dame, and he was like, I can't get taken seriously in anything other than that. So I said, well, why don't we put on our own play? So we, in the pub in the Duke of York, decided to... put something on for a local arts festival, for the Cathedral Quarter Arts Festival, because I couldn't get seen at the theatre. So I couldn't get seen at Lyric, couldn't get seen at the Abbey, couldn't get seen at OMAC, none of these regional theatres. So I thought, if this isn't working, then I have to create work for them to see me, to prove to them that I can do this. So we decided to do Jim Cartwright's 2. We applied for the rights and didn't get them, which ironically, we went ahead and did it. I ended up working with Jim's son about 15 years later, and I told him that story thinking he'd laugh, and he was like, I'm going to tell my dad. And I was like, please don't. So we did 2, and that's how I got seen.
So starting out from GSA, right, before you know that it's going to be very hard, even though your mum's told you it's going to be hard, I'm assuming, correct me if I'm wrong, that you left GSA with at least a modicum of hope.
Oh, yeah.
Thinking, I could be the person in the year that works.
Oh, we all do, yeah.
So what was your expectation on graduation of what might unfold in the following 3-5 years?
I thought
genuinely, what was your kind of... Genuinely, we all visualize things.
I thought I was
going to
be at the National or the RSC or the Globe. I mean, I thought it was going to be brilliant. And to make matters worse, the BBC were following me and my best friend Gigi around for this documentary called Theatre Biz, where they were following 2 graduates, and they pitched me and her against each other, where Gigi went on to be really successful and I completely failed. And that's all on television.
To emphasize that. Yeah, yeah.
And it's all on television. And it was
So you were a failed actress.
I thought it was going to be
on TV.
And oh yeah. And everybody on telly saw.
Oh man, that's grim.
It was massively humbling, really humbling. But you know, if you want, like, you don't do acting because you want to do it. You do it because there's nothing, like, you have to. It's like, I wouldn't ever choose this life. It wouldn't be something I think any of us would choose, you know, willingly.
I have this thing I keep coming back to, like, there's worse things than being the out of work actor. Like, I always think of that scene in what's the movie, the British movie?
With Neil and I.
Full Monty.
Oh, Full Monty, yeah.
It's in fucking The Commitments.
Oh,
and the guys are queuing off for the dole, and he says, it feels much better being an unemployed musician than an unemployed pipe fitter.
And well, I always my husband's think, a plumber, like, so I don't know. Right.
But I always think that because you've held on to what it is, because you held on to your dream.
Yeah, you've held on to what you want to do.
That as long as you can find solace in that, and obviously there are points at which it wears thin. But I always think, like, at least when I'm out of work, I can go for a walk. And,
yeah,
you know,
but I think you're feeling very positive and speaking very positively. I think one of the things, you're not old.
Don't bring me down.
But I think
I have a feeling you're going to bring me down, Verna.
No, well, I think one of the major issues in our industry is there's a mental health crisis. And I think that not every actor when they're out of work feels that way.
No,
and
totally.
Sometimes hard to find. And not to say, I mean, I've got to say, I didn't struggle like that at all in terms of my mental health. I've been very lucky. But as you know, both you and I have lost quite a few of our friends who are actors to mental health issues. And that there is a bit of a crisis with that. So I think that's why I say you wouldn't choose it, is because, you know, I think I've lost my 6th friend in the last 3 years who's an actor to suicide and mental health. And
that's a bigger societal issue as well, you know, and it's definitely something that needs looking at, because it's only getting worse, right? And I don't mean to be flippant about that, like, but it's something in me anyway, and I can only speak for me, that is, I do get those. I look at my friends, especially since I moved home, and they've got really good jobs. I went to a really good school, they took the arts really seriously as a side, as a sideline, mm-hmm. right? So it was Shakespeare Festival, all that stuff. But like, mm-hmm. you know, I said I wanted to do something in TV or media for sixth year for work experience, and they sent me to a solicitor's office. So like they thought they were doing me a favor, like, no fucking mission of that happening. And so I have friends like RMP was one of my year group, mm-hmm. or, you know, my physiotherapist that I go to at my back is one of my classmates. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody that I know when I play football with them are all like surgeons and fucking barristers and judges and all sorts, right? And you can't not look at that and go, I'm a failure. Of course I could fucking come away from football, and depending on how I played, I might think I'm a fucking star, or I might start going, see the guys drive off in their nice cars.
I bet you're happier than them. I bet you any money you're happier than them.
Well, the weird thing is, from their point of view, they think I'm living the dream.
Yeah.
Right. So they're always like, hey, Donny, I was turning on Netflix already, and then you popped up, and they're always like bright eyed and like, fuck it. And you're like, yeah, I mean, I just got my tax payment for £3.12 for that. Like, you know, if you knew the reality.
Working about three other jobs.
Do you know what I mean? Oh, so it's always, it's grass is greener, right? And so I guess it's just knowing that and being able to reframe
your
own situation in a way that's positive.
It's very difficult. And I try and talk about this lots to young actors I work with, is the career trajectory is not normal the way it would be for a surgeon or a lawyer or a solicitor or somebody like that, where you work hard and then you work your way up. Like with our job, you go up, down. And like when I got Hollyoaks, I experienced fame like I had never known it, being in a soap where you're in a show 5 days a week and paps following you around and living in Liverpool. And it was absolutely insane, and money that I'd never, ever dreamt of earning. And then you go from that to then no job at all. And I was working as a nanny. And that was really humbling, because I had just done the second season of The Fall. And so that was, you know, I was known and seen for being in The Fall, and then picking these six children up. And then actually Hollyoaks brought a character breakdown out, because they wanted to bring a character like mine from the show back into the show. And I had about six or seven Northern Irish actresses ringing me to ask for advice, because they were going in, and basically the character breakdown was mine. It was saying, we want her to be like Cheryl, but new. But it was very humbling to kind of go, like, this is just, it's just such an odd life to go, like, you know, 5 years ago, this was my life, and now this is my life. And then
Do you find that difficult? Do you find that shift between the kind of feast and famine element of it?
Yeah. I used to feel a lot more panicky about it until I met my husband. And then, funnily enough, like when I met him, I felt much, just as a person, on a personal front, I felt much more settled. And I felt like I had less to prove and less to push. And it's that age-old adage, when you stop pushing, more things come to you.
Mm.
So, and I started really pursuing interests outside of acting. I think we all become very obsessive about our career and our job. And the more obsessive sometimes you can become, the more unhappy it can make you, but also the less fruitful it can be. And
totally.
Richard is a plumber. He didn't own a telly, had no interest. I mean, he's very supportive.
He's a very creative man, though, Richard.
Yeah, but he had no interest in acting in that sense. So it was very grounding. And I got into being more active and going out and doing other things, and suddenly having more of a life other than it just being acting all the time. And that's been life-changing for me. It really has.
That's the difficult thing, is you couldn't have got where you got to if you hadn't been a person who was willing to work hard for it.
Mm.
But equally, there has to be a point in your life where you go, I need something else.
You need to breathe. And absolutely. And I think it, you know, and I try and, like I say this to the young actors I work with so much as well, is develop passions and really encourage those passions that are outside of acting, because not just for your own mental health, but also because you might be able to create some sort of business around that will help to give you the self-worth and self-esteem and confidence of doing something. Like, I've got a young lad, Oren, who went to GSA, who's moved back to Belfast, and he's the most incredible illustrator, stunning illustrator. And for the last 2 years, he's been crafting and working that and building his little business as an illustrator. And I think what that can do for your self-esteem when you've got other avenues and interests is so important. But also it's really important to have control, because as an actor, we have zero control over those kind of things. So to be able to have a project or your own endeavor, you know, I've got another friend that has an ethical t-shirt company, and that's actually become her huge success now. But that, what that gives her, and that feeling that it gives her of kind of something that she's put into and something's come out, really helps her through the down times as an actor, you know?
I think that we're moving increasingly to a point where we stop telling the story that the dream is, the attainable dream is, you don't do anything else.
That it's
realistic for any of us to even do think we're working towards the point where that's all we do. We do it unless we marry a barrister or shack up with, you know, justice of the peace or whatever. And realistically,
there's a lot less shame. There's a lot less shame around it. I mean, apart from obviously Katie Jarvis was like absolutely trolled through it by the scum, but you know, that's the scum. They'll troll anybody through it. But I think it's becoming much more normalized that actors have many, many, many other jobs. So I've never been funny about saying all the different jobs that I have done and I continue to do. You know, I teach at a drama school now, 2 days a week, and that definitely helps to keep me going and keep me earning money and paying bills. But also, as an actor, we have to have these jobs because in order to be good actors, because you have to have a life and you have to know how to fill these lives of these characters that you're playing. So I'm so glad that I think a lot of shame is being taken away from all of that. And I honestly think that your podcast has been quite instrumental in that over the last few years, of being able to hear what people would deem successful. And I say that in quotation marks, you know, successful actors, seeing what their journey has been and what other jobs they've done and what it's been like for them, because it destigmatizes everything. And, you know, the more honest we are and the more transparent we are about pay, I had a big issue with that with Hollyoaks, with when I found out one of my male co-stars was on more money than me and I was there longer than him. Like, he then agreed to be transparent with his pay, and we all then agreed to be transparent with their pay. I think things like that are really important, and transparency around the truth of what it's like.
How they keep us down, man. It's how they keep us afraid.
It's power. It's absolutely
totally
what it is.
What's the longest you've gone without work?
God, ages. Ages. Like, I'm out of work longer than I am working, always. And as you said, it looks like we're way more successful. I mean, I don't know, 18 months? Probably 18 months.
Yeah.
But that's been regularly, like having years, a year or 18 months. Like, it was hard when I left Hollyoaks. It was very difficult to, and even though I'd done The Fall, it was very difficult to shrug the soap jacket off your shoulders. And, you know,
remember people saying stuff like, what's the exit strategy from a job like that? You know, like, how do you get out of a job like that? Must be tough, I think, as well as that, to go from that into a regular job and all of that.
A plan. I mean, you know what I'm like. I'm such a fucking hustler. I had a plan and the plan still didn't go to place. Like, I had an exit strategy. Like, I planned the whole fucking thing, like Succession. Like, I knew what I wanted to do. And it was, I'm only going to leave this job if I get a great drama, got the great drama, then left the job and didn't realize that the great drama, like your role in it, might not head off, you know, that it would be your male co-star that would become the most famous man on the planet and the most successful man on the planet. And you would go back to nanny, and, you know, it's like, it's all very humbling and really, but it's so good for you, because I wouldn't swap it for the world, because it's made me who I am and led me to where I'm at. And also having the anonymity that I have now compared to when I was in the soap is brilliant, because you're allowed to have freedom to do your job again, which is observe people and watch people and live your life, you know? And so I really wouldn't change it for the world, but it never turns out the way you plan it. And that's what being an actor is, isn't it? It's like,
An agent once told me, PD, that an actor's only ever truly happy in the 5 minutes after they get the phone call to say they've got the job, after which time the self-doubt kicks in. Do you recognize yourself in that? And if not, why not?
Not really. He said the same thing to me as well. And not really for me, because I genuinely am so happy.
We both must have been fucking miserable and anxious. And
I was miserable and anxious often when I was with him, but not.
Bruna.
Jonathan. You'll work.
I know.
Do you know what? I am always
hashtag in jokes.
Really happy when I'm on set and working, or in a rehearsal room and working. I just wish it could be more often. And I'm sure every actor feels like that. Like it doesn't. I think probably the most negative place I ever worked for in terms of morale was in the soap, because you're in the same job playing the same role every day. And I was in that show for 5 years. So the negativity amongst the cast can get quite moany and quite like, you know. And I said to myself I would leave whenever I felt like I was becoming like that person. And I'm so glad I did, because I never wanted to be bitter about it and I never wanted to be unhappy. I'd rather be poor and happy and fulfilled than a bitter rich actor, which I do know quite a lot of bitter rich actors.
So on the subject of getting that job and getting subsequent jobs after that, do you believe in big breaks? Or have you believed in any moment in your past that you were in the midst of the big break?
I always think every job I'm doing is my big break, and then it never.
That's me. That's fucking me.
I swear everything I do.
I only just realized like, as you said that. I was like, that's me.
Like, if I'm being really honest, everything I get, I'm like, oh my God, this is it.
If I'm doing a fucking short film, I'm like, this could be the short film that people see and they go, oh my God, I never thought of him like that. This is my Oh my God,
I'm having an Olivia moment. Like I literally, like every job I do, Jonathan, I am like that. But do you know what?
Yeah, you wouldn't do, otherwise you wouldn't do. I said this about the shorts when I made the short films, like I was convinced the first one was going to win a BAFTA, because it was like, otherwise, why would you fucking make the film?
Well, 100%.
Like, do you know what I mean? If you don't think you're going to win a BAFTA, don't bother your arse.
Exactly. And that's what drives us. And that's what I love, is that feeling of excitement when you start a new job thinking this could be the one, because it means that you give 110%. And, you know, as you know, things don't work out the way you thought they were going to be, but that's not my business. And that's actually not any of my business or my job to worry about. My job to worry about is treating that opportunity like my big opportunity and giving it 110%, and then whatever happens happens, you know. Like it's not to do with that, it's about the work.
So how important, if you're talking about work, how important is talent versus say luck, which would be the dictating factor, you know, in lots of people's careers? And I've certainly have been lucky at points and unlucky at others. But how much do you, in the scales on which one side is talent and the other is luck, where do you think it's weighted?
Do you mean in terms of success or what matters?
Yes, in terms of success.
Yeah, but you know, it's funny because throughout my career, I've met a lot of both and a lot of mixtures of both, and who have had varying degrees of success. And it's one of those things where I'm sure you've done it yourself as well, where you look at someone and go, how have they got to where they are? Like, what are they, the emperor's new clothes? Like, are they literally, like, everybody thinks that their shit is rolled in glitter. And I think they're the worst fucking actor I've ever met in my entire life. And I'd rather act opposite a Primark hanger, you know, like that's what. Yeah. But, you know, I guess acting is such a taste thing and it's such an opinion that I sometimes look around and think, am I the only one that has this opinion? Or does everybody else think this person is amazing? And have they played this game really, really well? And so it's such a mix. And then you get those delicious moments when you're in a bar or a pub with someone and you're like, oh my God, you think the same thing? Yes. Yeah. Like, it's such a culmination and a mixture of both. And I think if there's one thing that I could change about the industry in terms of that kind of thing, it was, I wish that nice people and people who are sound and who work hard, because I think nearly everyone has a good amount of talent. Nearly everyone has a good amount of talent. There's some absolute shower of shites out there where you go, Jesus Christ, how have you got there? But, you know, majority-wise...
Generally, the standard's higher than you like to believe, I think.
You walk into an audition room or into Spotlight and you're like, Jesus, that girl is amazing and she's brilliant. I loved her and that. And then you sort of see who got it and you're like, oh, that's interesting. And I think sometimes it can be different for different types of people. I've found a lot that the reason I don't get jobs is because of my physicality or the way I look. So there was a big American series that I auditioned for 5 months that a girl who was 23 ended up getting, who was stunning, like a model.
You're nearly 30.
And it was to play a 37, but that's very kind of you. It was to play a 36-year-old mother of a 12-year-old.
Oh, fuck off.
I was 33 when I auditioned for it, 34, and she was 23 and she got it. And so there's a lot of things like that where I kind of think, exhausting about the physical. And like when I've gone to work in LA, I've found it incredibly draining and exhausting. And if it hadn't have been for my time being in Hollyoaks and therefore being trawled through the News of the World and the Scum and the Daily Fail, you know, I've had everything written about my body. I've had the nastiest things written about my appearance and the way I look and how fat and ugly I am. I honestly could have anything thrown at me and I'd be able to handle it now, because once you've had that, it's like there's nothing more to throw at you. So LA was like, it's much of the same. But that I find that exhausting, because until the people in power change, it's kind of like, oh, like it's sometimes, most of the people are talented, but it's not even to do with luck. Sometimes it's to do with so many other factors that you have to surrender yourself and go, if I'm not for them because of the way I look or the fact that I remember my American agent sending me up for this part of a 52-year-old woman because I hadn't had Botox. And she was like, you're my only client that hasn't had Botox. So like, I have to put you up for that role. And I was like 32 at the time. And you're like, wow, this is LA. Like, and you kind of think,
next level.
That world, I don't want to tell that story. I'd rather go home to working my 2 or 3 different paying jobs that are normal in quotation marks jobs, and get the one little indie project or the one wee short film or the ITV series that, you know, it's playing a guest star in it or whatever, but it's a great story and a great script. I'd rather go back to that and keep my integrity, because the only thing you can ever take with you is your integrity. And I know that from being in a glamour show, you know, and why I never took my clothes off for the calendar and why I never did the FHN shoots or the Knots or Zoo shoots, is because the only thing you can ever take with you is your integrity. That's it. Everything else they own, you know.
So if, as you say, generally the standard is good, or generally people are good, actors are, as I found it when I started the audition in London, if you're a certain level, everybody get into the room. There's a kind of, that's why it's so hard to get an audition, right? Largely, there are people, obviously, that we think, but do you think acting's hard?
No. I think people actually overcomplicate things. And that's one of the things that I think is a problem with drama school and institutions, is I think people overcomplicate it. And you actually have to strip it back way, way back down. The actual physical act of acting is about surrendering yourself and being vulnerable, and the power of vulnerability and allowing yourself to just be. The career of acting is hard. But if you can learn to master feeling comfortable in a way that is allowing yourself to be naked in every sense of the way, then it's about just being and resisting the urge to push and to do and to display and to add all these different things on. I think we overthink it, we overteach it, we overemphasize on that. And for me, I think it's much simpler than it needs to be. And that's what I'm passionate about teaching with my young actors that I work with, is like, everything everyone tells you makes it sound so difficult. It's not. Go back to your instinct, you know?
So what is the most difficult thing about being an actor then?
Not having any control, I think, for me, is feeling like you have very a small sense of power, less power to and control. And I think that gets harder as you get older, certainly in your 30s and then moving into your 40s. I think, and I'm learning more as I get older, to voice my opinion more. I used to be very much a people pleaser for directors and writers and just, take notes and do it and not challenge or question things. And actually, I think it's really important that you stand up for the things that you believe are important, because that's part of your craft and your opinion is valid. It's just we're told constantly it's not, because you get things cut and you get things changed and you get, you know. And so for me, I find that hard. I find no control over my own sense of destiny. I find that very difficult. And I'm trying to learn to surrender myself more to that, and give that up and just not know what's going to happen.
Has being an actor, are you conscious of it having affected personal relationships?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. I've only got married 2 years ago. I really struggled with personal relationships with partners up until then. To begin with, it was me probably putting my acting career first over that. And then later on, when I had some degree of success, it was partners not being able to deal with you earning more money than them and kind of being in the public eye. That was an issue. And maybe attracting the wrong kind of partner. Definitely when I was in the soap, that was hard. But I think now I've met the right person. I've learned to let go of so much and not care about the industry as much, not care about what people think about me so much, because I feel very secure in my relationship, you know.
What does Rich make of the job? Like, I'm guessing he never dated an actress before you, actor, actress. So what did he make of that in those first kind of few months of encountering that for the first time?
He's been amazing. And I think that's why he's my right person and my right lobster, is because he's been amazing. And the reason it's been an issue before is because people haven't been able to cope with me being away for long periods of time, the uncertainty and the instability of it, and also being with other, you know, intimate scenes with other male actors and stuff. Some partners I've been with weren't able to cope with that. But Rich is amazing with all of that stuff. I think the thing he finds the most difficult is when I have to go away for long periods of time. So at the moment, we've been isolated because I'm shielding apart for 4 months and I'm just about to start a job that was meant to start before lockdown. And I'm going up to Manchester for 15 weeks. And so that's like 8 months of being apart. And that's really, really hard for him. And when I have to work in Canada and stuff, I think he finds that. That's the hardest part. But in terms of the craft and the job, he's got no jealousy. He's got nothing but admiration and kind of interest, but not too much interest in it. And I think it's because
a passing interest.
Yeah, like he's not overly interested, but he's excited for me when I'm talking about stuff. But he doesn't lecture me. He doesn't tell me what to do. And he's not overly interested. And it grounds you. But also, I think when you find a partner that's quite different from you, quite opposite from you, you bring out the best qualities in each other. Like he's very shy and very reserved, and I'm much more outgoing and chatty. And I think we both balance each other out, you know, and I think that's really important.
Do you think doing what we do has a psychological impact, short or long term?
Yeah, I kind of do. I kind of do. And I think sometimes, depending on the kind of roles you've played, or the, and it's not just in terms of filming or being on stage, but the things that you don't get, and then that as well can be an issue. But I found when I did The Fall, I found that very, very hard to shrug. And a lot of the research I'd done for that, a really dark place. And then I did a series called Unforgotten that was loosely based on the Millie Dowler case, and I read Gemma Dowler's biography and then did a lot of research into that. And I find I think as actors, we're very empathetic people, and we kind of really throw, you feel hard and you feel other people's emotions yep. And experiences hard. And I think that can sometimes be difficult to shed. And I certainly know other actors that are brilliant, but are absolutely cuckoo. Like, do you know what I mean?
Most.
Like there's a girl I know who's absolutely phenomenal, but she is cuckoo, totally cuckoo. Yeah. And I think it's because some of the roles she's played, like there's some actors I know that get those same roles again and again, and you see how that's haunted them and affected them, you know?
Yeah. And being angry all the time.
Yeah.
You know, I find things where I'm angry all the time or where I'm drinking all the time. You know, mm-hmm. as soon as you finish work, the first thing you want to do is have a drink. Like, it's bizarre how that stuff works in your mind.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing then, do you think that the kind of the rejection and all those things take a toll, or do you think that those are the things that maybe, from your perspective anyway, it seems you found coping mechanisms and perhaps they've made you stronger in some way?
Yeah, I think it's a mix of both. There's lots of things that have been more determined and more kind of like, well, fuck them, I'm going to do it anyway. And yeah. But then there are things that are crushing and soul destroying. I think my experience of being in the public eye and being kind of like meat on a plate for everyone to dissect was a very big learning curve for me in learning to take
horrible.
People's opinions with a pinch of salt. And things really changed for me after that because I stopped caring. Before that, I cared a lot and I cared about rejection. Whereas when you've had that sort of experience, you just go, do you know what? Fuck is all. Like,
yeah, you kind of almost expect it.
Yeah, and you're just not interested. And the rejection can be hard. For me, I find it difficult because so many of the people that are in the room with you that are auditioning as well are so talented as well. Mm. And that you kind of look at the room that you're in and go, God, I've seen three or four of them and they're brilliant. And how on earth do you? And like, so it just becomes hard because you think, well, I couldn't choose, you know, there's
I
not
think the weird thing psychologically from my perspective of being an actor as well is like, if I've been in that situation where I've looked around the room and thought, God, that person's great. Even if I get the job, I don't go, fuck, well done me. I go, they must have made a mistake, or maybe that other person turned it down, or like maybe they weren't available in the end. Like, it's never, for me anyway, the thing that I've found over the years is I had to keep on reminding myself, like, I never allow myself to revel in the victories. It's always like,
yeah.
So like, I've been looking around the room going, they're all amazing, I'll never get it. And if I get it, it's a mistake, or I'm going to be found out, or all that stuff kicks in, you know?
You see, when I've not got things, though, and I don't know if this is just because the kind of roles I got for are very character-y kind of roles. Most of the women or men, there's a lot of roles I go up for, which is different genders that are up for the same role and they haven't decided if it's going to be a man or a woman yet. They're so different and from such a diverse group of people that you go, it's always someone so physically different or looking to me or a different gender or something like that, that I go, it's choice. And so I think it might be easier for me because it's such a different, there's such character-y roles and I actually normally, when I do see the people that have got it, I would say 8 times out of 10 go, fair play, actually, they were better for it. I think the things that are difficult for me is when I think they've made a bad creative decision.
Do you watch? I can't fucking watch shit. I can't. I've said this before many times. I cannot watch the shit that I haven't been cast in.
Well,
I find it too painful.
I have a lot of the time because they're my mates. Because obviously being from the north of Ireland, like, it's such a small pool of actors that it ends up being your mates.
Have you ever considered giving up?
Yeah, loads. Yeah, loads.
Why? What kind of things make you go, ah, do you know what? Fuck this.
Money. Loss.
Yeah.
And then something.
Lack thereof.
A different job comes along, you know, like nannying or sales job or write, you know, something else. And you go, oh, okay, I can pay the rent now. Like, it'll be okay. That's definitely a big factor. And I think the system, sometimes I look at the system and the way the industry is and I go, oh, I don't like, it's not a very pretty place sometimes, because some of the insidious bad stuff can make you go, it makes you feel a bit creeped out and a bit icky. And that sometimes I think plays with my morals and my moral compass and my values. But then I kind of try and find the positives and go, you know what, if you want to change something, you've got to be in it. You can't run away from it. You've got to be part of it. And if this annoys you, then you've got to be part of that change of making things, you know, better and not so one-sided, you know. But yeah, there has been lots of times I've thought of giving up. I think less so in recent years since I've found love. And that's genuinely because I feel more at peace with myself. And I just feel like it doesn't matter as much. And I try and say this to other younger actors that I work with all the time. And I get that that's as good as saying, you know, like kiss your own elbow, because you can't when you're 20. But if I could say something to my 20-year-old self, Jonathan's trying to kiss his own elbow.
What?
If I could say something to my 20-year-old self, it would be care less about it and look out and look up elsewhere, because I put so much energy and everything into that, and it's
so dull as well when you meet someone like that. It's incredibly dull.
Says
the guy who has a podcast about acting.
No, but
like, it is incredibly dull.
Everything, like, I know you have so many interests and other things that you do that give you life and give you kind of energy from. And I wish I'd known that 20 years ago, because I think I thought it was the be all and end all, and that if I put more in, I'd get more out. And that's just not the way it works in an acting career.
Yeah, unfortunately, but it's actually not. If it was that easy.
Sometimes if you put not less in, but sometimes if you look elsewhere and do other things, other stuff can unfold from places that you weren't looking. And I wish I knew that more. And I try and share that as much as I can, because, you know, that can suddenly open you opportunities and different kind of things up. So I definitely care less now, and actually weirdly I don't think about giving up so much now, because it doesn't matter to me as much now.
Yeah, giving up wouldn't be such a massive dramatic thing.
Give up, it's like it's no big deal. Whereas I think when you're 20-25, it's like, and especially being from the north of Ireland, I think there's this real thing of like having to prove yourself, and we've got such a chip on our shoulder of like never wanting to go home and look like we failed. Whereas now, I think failure is such a wonderful, you know, what is failure? But like, you know, what can be perceived as failure is brilliant growth.
It's funny you ask that, Bruno, because the next question is, do you consider yourself successful?
As a person, yes, absolutely. As a person, yeah. As an actor, I don't think it matters.
Yes.
I really don't. Like, as a person, what matters to me is being able to sleep at night and know that I've made good choices and I'm happy. And certainly in some jobs earlier in my career, I didn't like the person that I was becoming and the people that I was surrounded by and what that was making me become. And I'm very glad that I made the choice to leave that, because I like who I am better. And a lot of my friends have said, you're back, you're who, you know, in the last 10 years. And that to me is successful, not how much money I earn and not what my IMDb.
How much money do you earn? No, I said,
fuck all. But if you want a good bar,
there was a point that this is one of the things that questions that I think was probably in the very first draft of the question for series one, didn't make it through. There was a point in my life where I was checking my IMDb every Monday.
Oh, I used to. That's the person I didn't like that I was becoming, was this whole becoming obsessed with it. The job that I had been in, it was all about pages, column inches, press, positive press, appearances on other shows, your social media, IMDb ratings. And I saw other actors who...
Well, you're up this week, Bruna, so... I mean, you say that now, but I'm just looking at it.
Up
this week?
Jonathan, there was a piece that was written in me in the News of the World. I was in one of the last front pages of the paper before it went under, that crushed me so badly and really affected my mental health badly, that I vowed to never Google my name again, never read any papers or anything that is written about me, because it put me in such a dark place when I should have been celebrating a success, that I realized I did not need that, and that was not good for me. And so, that was part of my decision to leave that soap, was because it's like, I don't want to be this person that develops an eating disorder or develops a drug addiction, develops, you know, very bad habits and stuff, because I could see what it could do to you, and I didn't want to be a part of that. And so I feel I'm a successful person, and I don't care about the acting. I just want to tell stories. Sometimes I won't get paid for it, and sometimes I do get paid for it. But as long as I'm happy, and that's what matters to me.
So, great answer. You've already said if you were to give yourself advice, you would say care less.
Mm. Care less and do other things. I would
the
say,
minute my advice to myself is kind of a paraphrase. It's not a quote from Hamilton, but you know that talk less, smile more.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying eat less, move more. That's my new advice to myself.
I like
eat less, move more. Yes, that's what I'm. That's when I go over there, when I reach for the biscuit cupboard, I'm like, eat less.
You're not
like,
going to eat this biscuit. Yeah. You're not going to eat this. You're
eat this. This is good. We could rework this. This is good. This is all good shit. So,
yeah, I would also say, as well as
what would you say apart from
I would say do other things. Look to other things to spark joy.
Get a hobby that is fuck all to do with
and
performing.
I would also really advise my younger self and people who are like-minded that worry about money all the time is to find something you're passionate about that you can make money out of that's got nothing to do with acting, and to do that and to start developing that early on in your career, because it will give you such a wonderful sense of self-esteem and self-worth that will get you through those rejections and the worst parts of being an actor. And I think
what if your thing that you're passionate about is communism? It's really hard to make money from communism. I'm really passionate about socialism. Can you give me some advice?
Well, I can put you in touch with my grandfather, who's also a Red. So that's about the best advice I could give.
Comrade Waugh, right? Okay.
Comrade Doran, yeah.
If I was to put you in charge for a day, and actually, I'm really interested to hear what you say here, because I know you're very politically engaged and politicized, and in a good positive way, trying to activate people and organizations toward change. So if I could put you in charge for a day, what changes would be on the top of your list, socially or industry?
Oh, you froze. You're back.
I'm back.
You're back.
Did you answer?
No, I didn't.
Awesome.
If I was in charge for the day, the first thing I would do today would be to reverse the clause 17 on the protecting the NHS bill. Like, I'm passionate
about that.
I'm furious about that.
How the fuck? And then you realize, well, you elect the Conservatives in enormous numbers. Of course, they're going to fucking do that.
I feel passionately that we must protect our NHS, and that's one of the really, really good things that these islands have. And that
we learn nothing.
And also the fact that we're in the middle of a global pandemic, I find it absolutely astounding that people want to pay for healthcare when we're in, like, you know, you go, that's what that means, is we're going to have to pay for healthcare like America. So I would protect our NHS at all costs. I think a huge reform needs to be made within mental health, services. Across all these islands, there is, but of course, I'm especially passionate about the north of Ireland, because our suicide rates are absolutely astounding for Europe. And I think that housing, we need to sort the housing crisis out massively. And I'm sorry to say it for any of your listeners that are against it, but I'm passionately anti-Brexit. I think Brexit is one of the most damaging things that is come about in our lifetime, and I'm from Ireland, so I think it's important to protect all of our rights of being European. And I'm also
none of my listeners are for Brexit.
But I'm also really passionate about education, and I think we've really, really allowed education with the cuts that have come in with the Tory government. Education has been completely slashed, and I think that that's the root of so many of our problems, to do with racism and to do with social injustice and opportunity and jobs. And
education is the root of everything. It's the basic building block of everything.
Yeah.
Solving education solves almost everything, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd also, on a tiny note, just allow people who have civil partnerships in Northern Ireland to be able to make it legal, because it's infuriating that they can't. And I would also
make humanist weddings legal. I'm right with you. Yeah.
So, yeah, there's lots to celebrate.
What about the industry though? What about stuff you might change in the industry specifically, or do you just not?
No, there's loads I would like to change. I think we need to have more pay transparency, 100%. There needs to be more pay transparency across the board. I know that many production companies are trying very hard to do the let us know if it's a yes or a no, but that's still not happening quite across the board. So I think that's really important to just let an actor know whether you got the job or you didn't, just so you can let that go. Some of the turnarounds for tapes nowadays, that drives me
fucking
mad.
Fucking ridiculous. Like, here's your 12 pages, see, well, we'll have it by tomorrow.
So I think sometimes that can be really difficult, but you know, people like Victor Jenkins at the CDG and that whole network of casting directors are trying really, really hard to change that. And I just think that needs to continue a little bit more, definitely.
Yeah, definitely.
And I also just wish we could see more diverse casting with men and women and non-binary people that look normal. Like, and when I say normal, I just mean trying to get a bit of variation in who plays who and how they look. Because there still seems to be a very commercial look for men and women in things. And I find it not realistic. And I'm 37 now, and the roles I'm starting to read for, it's very interesting to see how that changes, especially for women.
So do you worry more about your health, your work, or your financial security? Health, career, or financial security?
It used to be sometimes health, because I have had some health issues, but they're doing much better now. And for a long time it was financial security. But now that I'm in a partnership with somebody, I feel much more like someone has my back. I think for a long time I was going out with people where I was the one that I felt like I had to cover everything all the time. And so that made me panic about money. But having a partner who has a very normal 9-to-5 job makes it feel like I can take some career risks with things, because we have some stability. And so that has been a really, I mean, I'm incredibly fortunate and grateful to be able to have that balance. So that I don't worry as much about financial, but I think everything would probably come down to that. Financial is the major thing, because we live in the United Kingdom and everything is expensive and they want to privatize our NHS. So
you want to leave Europe.
Like when you have health issues as well, you kind of think, oh my gosh, like, does this mean, you know, you just worry about costs of things and for your family members and everything as well. So, but career, I've given up worrying about that. And it's been very freeing to stop caring about, like, you know, I'm passionate about it and I want to do it very much, but like, I'm not going to give it the same worry that I did before.
Are you in anything at the minute?
No, nothing. I am in nothing.
And on that happy note, it falls to me to draw proceedings to a close and say, this has been a very different chat. I was conscious from the beginning that it was going to be a very different chat, and you're much more fascinating even than I'd given you credit for. I'm with a very, very interesting past as well. So thank you for sharing it all so honestly and so willingly.
Well, thank you for having me on. And honestly, Jonathan, like, thank you for doing the Honest Actors podcast, because I swear, listening to episodes when I was a nanny in 2016-17, it got me through. I would walk on the school run, and I'm not ashamed to say there was times listening to Denise's that I would cry with relief that someone else is going through the stuff that you're going through. So I know it's been a huge help, and I know from drama school students that I've taught that it's a huge help. So thank you for bringing the series back.
So there you go, another episode. We're back to one a fortnight, as I said at the top. So that's me until today, 2 weeks. Going to keep the Fridays for the time being anyway. Just to say thank you for listening, as always. Thanks to the people who are offering those one-off donations via supporter.acast.com/honestactors. The link is in the show description and in the episode description as well, if you'd like to become one of those people. Thanks to everybody who's given so far. And as I say, thanks for listening. Please do get in touch on Twitter at Honest Actors. Let me know what you're thinking, and it'd be great to hear from you. Until then, till next time anyway, speak to you soon.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.